of Education Policy and Finance Committee will come to order. Welcome. Sorry it's so cold. I got a report from up in my area, and on the 13th, it was minus 40 degrees actual temperature at the, out in the vineyard, and today it was about 36 below.
Does that make good wine?
It could be a little tough on the berries next spring. But the good news is that it's supposed to warm up. So, well, today we have a presentation that I think even members who have seen it before in the past should enjoy it. But I would also toss out a kind of a little bit of a challenge to members to look at the different facets of education finance that's going to be presented by our staff, and then keep in the back of your mind that we will probably be asked in some fashion or some form to participate in the balancing of the state's deficit. And so as we get ourselves up to speed on education finance, there's the potential, hopefully, for some change or way change of doing things or ways of doing things that we might be able to make our system more efficient or the delivery a little bit less costly. And I think that's the challenge for all of us. So I don't know who's going to start up there. Mr. Nauman, I'll turn it over to you.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Eric Nauman, fiscal staff, for the record. And myself and Shelby McQuay have prepared this briefing as we do every 2 years. And generally, we do it over a two-day period. There's about... we could stretch this to 4 hours of content, but we're going to endeavor, due to the Bill Gates issues from last Tuesday, to get this down to 2 hours. And that's probably appropriate, given that most of you have seen a lot of the content that we went through 2 years ago. We tend to do this after every election cycle as a good opening to the budget cycle. For those of you that haven't sat through this, we would be pleased to spend a little bit more time, because we will go through some of the charts fairly quickly. I also will mention that if we're going too quickly on a particular item, the floor is open for questions, as it always is. Stop us, ask us to go through something. That's probably enough said. We'll begin with the budget process. I will, of course, remind you of the constitutional mandate. We'll talk about some basic education finance terms, talk about the forecast in the state budget. Some of this we covered on Tuesday, but I think it's useful maybe to put some pictures to the conversation that we had. The 2001 reform and the 2003 budget cycle, I think, are important instructions for where we go in the future. We'll talk about some pupil accounting, delve into general education, the referendum, talk about reserves, penalties, special ed, capital facilities, early childhood, and where you want to get some more information if needed, and then who your staff resources are for the committee. So we'll start with the budget process and some basic terms. The timelines are pretty familiar to this committee. We begin with an instruction and advisory to agencies by the executive agencies, and the instructions are fully issued, agency requests. The forecast occurs in November. Session begins. That's where we are now. In January, the governor's budget will come late February. The February forecast will occur also in late February. Then the price of government, budget resolutions, committee deadlines, conference committees, and theoretically completion. These documents we talked about yesterday, and the idea was, Tuesday was to get through some of those, so unless there's a need, I'll skip over this. I usually read this every 2 years. I won't do it now, but it does provide a roadmap for this committee that other that other committees don't always have. Transportation has a constitutional mandate as well. I think this guides. You want me to read it, Senator mm-hmm. Clark? I will read
Mr.
it.
Mr. Clark. I think the typing on that's so small that it just would be really helpful to make
There are accompanying charts to go with
it. I know there's handouts, but it's such a motivating.
Mr. Chair and Senator Clark, the stability of a Republican form of government depending mainly upon the intelligence of the people, it is the duty of the legislature, this is your job, to establish a general and uniform system of public schools. The legislature shall make such provisions by taxation or otherwise as will secure a thorough and efficient system of public schools throughout the state.
Thank you.
When we give this to graduate school classes, we usually ask them what they think it means, and as many people as are in the class are about as many answers as we get. That said, pretty much every state in the union has an education clause in its constitution, and it is a good guide. We can litter the court system with what this means, but it does give you something that other committees don't have. It's something to claw your teeth into and talk about, and I would encourage you to do that on a policy basis.
Senator Romo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and probably most of the committee knows this, but sometimes it's worth remembering that in 1933, during the midst of the Depression, is when Minnesota established the income tax to pay for public education. Isn't that right?
I'm not certain of the date, Senator Romo, but I trust you on it.
One other facet that we just had this conference that many legislators went to yesterday, and it was quite interesting to the panel that spoke at lunch. A number of them, one was the CEO of General Mills, and most of them were actually business leaders of one area or another. Many of them spoke about the importance of the education component to government. And I think the whole day, everybody spoke of the increased productivity. If Minnesota is going to really compete in the 21st or in the years ahead, it's going to have to be tied to increased productivity, which is tied to education. And so I think that really backs up the importance of education. I think all of us realize that there's other things happening, such as the demographic shift and age and population and things like that. But I don't think we can afford to lose the importance of how education relates to everything else.
As we talk about some of the school finance terms, it's important. I think some of the most fundamental is the difference between revenue, levy, and aid. For school districts, it's money. But for us, the revenue is the funds available for school districts to spend. Levy is money raised off of the property tax. Aid, in a particular formula, is the amount of state aid that this committee and the entire legislature appropriates. And usually a good rule of thumb is the aid equals the revenue minus the levy, or put a different way, aid plus levy equals the revenue. I know it seems simple, but sometimes we get caught up in these terms and it's easy to get sort of lost in them. ADMs, we have a lot of acronyms in education. ADMs is average daily membership. In real simple terms, although not precise, these are basically an average count of kids in the classroom. WADMs are weighted average daily membership, and we'll get into how we weight them in a moment. AMCPUs and RMCPUs, these are a mouthful. Adjusted marginal cost pupil units or resident marginal cost pupil units. And the reason we have marginal cost pupil units has to do with declining enrollment, and we'll talk about that in a moment. ANTC is a measurement of tax capacity, adjusted net tax capacity. Most K-12 formulas that have a levy component use ANTC, but not exclusively. The other tax base is called referendum market value. There's a couple of those, and primarily the operating referendum. An allowance, I think this is an important term as well. It's a statutorily determined number that, when multiplied by the number of pupils, generates an amount of revenue for school districts. Equalization is the process of reducing the impact of property wealth to generate revenue for school districts by appropriating state aid. And we'll talk about that in a little bit more detail, too. An equalizing factor is a number that we burn into law relative to a tax base that helps us go through the equalization process. Fiscal year, again, this is probably pretty obvious, too, but it's the 12-month budgeting period. And for school finance and the state of Minnesota, it begins July 1 and ends June 30th. So we're going to be setting the budget. I think useful, the school year 08-09 is the same as fiscal 09, and we will be setting the budget for fiscal year 10 and 11. Straightforward. Now, I warned you about aid and levy splits and equalization. Policy to minimize the impact of a property wealth in a particular district kind of works like this. The higher a district's property value, the more revenue is raised through levy. And for a given amount of revenue, the poorer district will receive a greater percentage of state aid, and conversely, the wealthier district will receive lesser amounts of state aid. And you can visualize it like this. We've got a few districts along the bottom, just hypothetical ones, and revenue value per pupil. So between 700 and 800 is the amount of revenue we're raising, but the yellow portion is state aid. So the wealthier district on the right, districts 5 and 6, they're going to raise most of that revenue off of the property tax, while the poorer districts will receive higher proportions of state aid.
When you look at that chart, if you, let's say, took the district of in northern Minnesota, let's say, where there's 50% of the property wealth was in seasonal recreational land, how do they this varies from let's say a debt service levy versus a referendum type levy?
Mr. Chairman, it does. The debt service levy is imposed, and this is the difference really between the adjusted net tax capacity tax base versus the referendum market value tax base. The tax base that you described on the on seasonal rec, that exclude the referendum is not imposed on the seasonal rec, whereas that is included in the ANTC. For debt service, they are taxed on that. This is an issue that crosses between both the tax committee and the education committee. How? Because when we make a change in the tax committee to the tax base, we usually need to make adjustments to the equalizing factors. That's that number burned into law where we make a division to determine the slope of the line. So that's what the equalizing factor does, is determine that slope. So if you were hypothetically to add the seasonal rec back onto the referendum, we would need to make an adjustment to the equalizing factor so that the state aid on a statewide basis remains exactly the same. Or we would have to spend some money, probably. Does that answer your question?
Yes, I just wanted to point out that depending on the tax base, that equalizing factor changes.
Okay, continue with some terms. Free and reduced lunch is a measurement of poverty. It's the best one that we have. It's not perfect. But it allows, we use this for primarily the compensatory formula. An aid entitlement, I think this is a real useful thing to think about, because we'll talk about entitlements versus appropriation, and we sort of touched on this on Tuesday. Entitlement is the amount that's attributable to a given fiscal year for a district off of a given formula. But the aid may actually be paid over a couple of years. And when we talk about the shifts in a few moments, that becomes a critical factor, what the schedule is that entitlement gets paid over years. Categorical aids are, this is basically everything except the formula allowance. We talk about those as categoricals, including special ed. It's a categorical program, although a federally mandated one. An appropriation is the amount of state aid that the legislature actually pays to districts and charters in a given year. Again, in some cases, this consists of a portion of an aid entitlement from one year and a portion from another year.
Is free and reduced The measure of poverty, is that generally accepted in most states?
Most states are using it. Prior to 1997 and the welfare reforms, we were using an AFDC count. But because the federal law changes on welfare put a cap on some of the welfare programs, that ceased to become an accurate measure. Or we were concerned that as people fell off the welfare counts, that we would then be excluding a number of kids and penalizing those kids whose parents were falling off the welfare program. So we switched to the free and reduced lunch. The problem with free and reduced lunch, of course, is that as kids age into high school, there's a stigma associated with saying, yep, I need to file for that free and reduced lunch. Although I think school districts are getting a little bit better about that than they were in the late 90s. Okay. Education finance budget, past actions, my little joke, getting shifty. Here's a high-level summary of the education budget for the last biennium and projections for the next biennium. You can see that the vast majority is general education. The next biggest piece is special ed, and we'll talk about that at the end of the briefing. You've seen this on the spreadsheet. These are just summaries. And here's what the property tax levies look like for the same period. I'll note here that we have a new category, OPEB, pension debt service. The tax committee added in the tax bill last year a new K-12 levy. It didn't come through this committee. Senator Clark is looking at me. This relates to a change in government accounting practices called GASB 45, where school districts and other local governments have to begin recognizing post-retirement, post-employee pension benefits as a liability against their books. And many were concerned that these districts and cities and counties would not have the ability to pay for those as they began to recognize the liability, which they had previously not done. And so the tax committee created a levy for that for districts to pay for those, and that we're projecting about $30.4 million in levy impact. And basically the tax committee created that levy, and we're now recognizing it on this side of the ledger. We talked about this. This is the structural forecast a little bit on Tuesday. The difference between the revenues and the spending in the forecast is 2.16. If you then bring in the beginning balance and count that as revenue, there's about a $79,000 or $1 million difference between the revenues and spending, and then you make adjustments for the reserve, and that's where the 426 came in. As we talked about on Tuesday, the governor used that reserve of 155, left an allotment level of 271, which got us down to zero. And again, reminding you the conversation, we're probably not done with this fiscal year, that when February comes out and maybe even up to the close of session, we may be making adjustments to the 08-09. In 10 and 11, those are the numbers projected, the negatives for the difference between revenues and spending. So those are the remaining problem. If hypothetically you were to take K-12's proportion of that, it's about 1.8, and I use the percentage of E-12 spending as a total of the general fund. It's about 37.8 in the 10-11 biennium. These are the numbers that would be our responsibility. Now, that's by no means to forecast that that's what it will be, but it just gives you some perspective of the size of K-12 relative to the problem. Senator Michelle, you asked about shifts.
Mr. Nauman, thank you.
Talk a little bit about shifts. There are two kinds of shifts that we've used in recent history, a payment shift and a property tax recognition shift. The payment shift relates directly to the difference between entitlements and appropriations. State aid is paid to districts in 23 payments throughout the school year. It's roughly every couple of weeks, unlike cities and counties, which get big lump payments we schedule payments to school districts every couple of weeks or so. And for most state aid payments, districts receive 90% of the current year's entitlement added to 10% of the prior year's entitlement. That's when we talk about the 90-10 payment schedule. That's what we're talking about. Property tax recognition shift is a little bit more complicated, but actually a little bit more common in Minnesota's history. Property taxes are paid throughout Minnesota in October and May, and school districts recognize most May payments as revenue in the subsequent fiscal year. So you pay it in May, we recognize it in the next fiscal year. The PTRS is an...
Senator Salzman.
If I have a voice here, is that because they don't get the dollars until, even though, you know, property taxes are paid in May, how soon until the money actually gets to the school district account?
They're paid at the local level, Mr. Chair and Senator Salzman, so that it would be available. It's an accounting entry, and frankly, I'd probably need to visit with Mr. Melcher to go into detail why the history of that. But I think the notion was to try to capture all the property tax payments in a single year. So it's really just holding it over for a couple of years. And I do know that while we pay them in May, some of them come in dribs and drabs up through and including June.
Senator Salzman?
So just to follow up, is that because you pay to the county then... Is there a time lag between when they actually pay the – that's, I guess, what I'm asking is how soon does the county actually pay the school district? And that you may not know the answer to that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Salzman, I don't know that, but I can't imagine that it would be terribly soon. And again, it's not a question of actually having the cash in hand. It's more having the sort of the credit that we know that this is what we're going to receive. And we know that in advance. Let us get some more information on that. Back to you.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Nauman, I'm just reading your statement there that you you take a portion of the property tax revenue and move it forward 1 year. But you say that you're moving it from 2011 to 2010. Isn't that moving it backward?
Where you stand on, Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, it's a semantical, yes. Where you stand depends on where you sit, I suppose.
If we're pulling it back for recognition rather than pushing it forward.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, how are you
interpreting forward?
Let's use the years. Right now, you make the payment. The payments are, most payments, not all, most payments are recognized for the current year. We will recognize the payments in the next fiscal year. So that's 2010 payments that are 20. We make the payment in May 09, and we recognize it in fiscal 10, which is July 09.
So we're reckoning it in the forward year.
So the way a property tax recognition shift works, and I didn't actually get to these next steps, is we make an accounting entry where instead of recognizing it after July 1 of 2009, which is in fiscal 10, we move that recognition actually a little bit more. This goes directly to Senator Salzman's point. More aligned with when the payment is actually made in the year in which it was paid.
So we're moving it back from what is
from 10, from fiscal 10 to fiscal 09. And then what we do is we take a comparable amount of state aid and eliminate that out of the payment. And this was done in 2003 legislature in addition to the payment shift.
So,
Senator Olson.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, we don't have a lot of property tax from our general education revenue left, so it's mainly the referendum that we would be able to do? Would we take property tax recognition? Would we take all property taxes that are even locally determined and make that shift? Can we do that?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, you can do what you want. I'll tell you right now, that 31%, think about it this way, 50% of the payment is made in October and 50% of the payment is made in May. So set the 50% of the October aside, because that's not what we're talking about. We're only talking about the payment that's made in May. And in current law, we are already shifting 31% of the referendum payment into the previous fiscal year. So that's already been made. So when we talk about the shift, you don't really get much referendum shift until you go above 31%. That said, we can look at the shifts that are the property tax tracking in this committee. There is a fair amount of property tax that's out there. You're correct that about most of it is in fact off the referendum, but we are expanding the property tax on a pretty regular clip, close to $150 million each year. So there is shift available. I can tell you that if you were to go to a full 50% shift on the property tax recognition shift, there's close to $500 million that's available to be shifted if you were to do that.
Okay. Mr. Nowman?
I skipped quickly over the payment shift, but I'd like to spend a moment or two on this because I think it's useful to think about. If we hold the entitlement the same, this is actually what we did in the 2002 and 2003 legislatures. So if we assume a payment, let's just a hypothetical entitlement of $50,000. And in the 2001, 2002 timeframe, we were making a payment of, we were on a 90-10 payment schedule. So you take that $50,000 and sort of split it apart. You first multiply the entitlement for L1 by 10%, because that's the lagging payment from the prior year. The 2002 payment continues to be multiplied by the 90%. So you have the two appropriation pieces of $5,000 and $45,000, and add those together, and that leaves you with the $50,000. That's how it worked then. That's how it works now. Then in 2003, we take that same $50,000, and of course, the entitlement would actually change over time with pupil counts and things. And we went to an 83-17 payment schedule in that year. So now what you're doing is you get $41,500, that's the current payment, because it's the $50,000 multiplied by 83, and you add those two numbers together, and you end up with $46,500. Tracking with me so far?
Mm-hmm.
Then the 2003 legislature went to an 80-20 schedule. You can see this progresses over time. And again, that same $50,000 multiplied by those two pieces. Now we're getting $40,000 as a current payment with an 8.5 together. So you're at 48.5 in an actual appropriation. And now in 2005... take that $50,000, multiply it by the 80%, and we're back to the $50,000. That's the one-time nature of this shift. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What we're going to look at here is sort of the history of shifts. Fiscal year 1983 was as far back as I went. We had a property tax recognition shift that went to the 32% level. And sometimes we'll know the amounts. $240.7 million is what we booked in savings at that time. And it was partially paid back in 85 and then in 96 through 99. So we took a long time to pay that back. And that was because the legislature had to vote on those changes every time. So now we have the automatic buyback, which makes it easier. So these are some of the histories. In 85, we reduced the shift. We bought some of it back, and then in 88 we expanded it. In 90 we expanded it. In 92 we expanded it. In 93 it reached the highest level up to that point. It was we were owing school districts about $688 million at that point because we went all the way to a 50% shift. And notice we're talking just about the property tax recognition shift here. Then in 94 we began to buy it back. In 96, it went back down to 18.1%, then 7% in 97. Also in 97, we were previously at an 85-15% payment schedule, and We bought ourselves back that extra 5% to for the first time go to a 90-10 payment schedule. Then in 1999, we were completely clean relative to where we think we ought to be now, which is a 90-10 payment schedule and a no property tax recognition shift, save the referendum, which again I referenced as already at that 31% level. Then in 2003, we had budget challenges again. We went first to the 83-17, and these numbers I have because I was here. We booked $437.5 million in shift savings off of the payment schedule, an 80-20 of $185.3, and then we did a property tax recognition shift. Not all the way to 50%, but we went to 48.6.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nauman. As long as we're talking about the property taxes, the local taxes, can you, you may have this later in your presentation. If so, I apologize for jumping the gun here. But can you talk a little bit about the percentage of statewide total funding for education that comes from local taxes versus what comes from state aid?
We do have that later.
Okay.
We'll get to that in a moment.
Senator Bonoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This chart shows us how the one-time money really is one time, because you get that big bang for your dollar when you first do this shift in 2003, and then when we decide it looks like we're still in trouble the next year and we want to do a further shift, it doesn't really get us very much. And so I think that's good for us to see here that while it may serve us in the short run, it's going to be just 1 year.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonoff, I think it's very clear that the reason to do a shift is the importance of a shift depends on the reason you're doing it, as we talked about on Tuesday. We went from that 240 all the way up to 688, and some of these numbers get a little nebulous, so I didn't put them on the page. But by 1993, this shift had grown to basically we're borrowing the money from school districts up to $688 million. And then we ultimately had to sort of claw our way back to that, to buy it back. The reason to buy it back, you could ignore it, is so that you have the shift available to you again. If we hadn't bought it back and bought the 02-03 shift, we wouldn't have these available to us, because you see that we went all the way to 80-20, which is as far as I'd recommend going, and we did almost a full 50% shift on the property tax recognition shift. If you hadn't bought those back, those resources wouldn't be available to you now. So here's the buybacks. These were done automatically based on forecast. The legislature in 2004 passed the automatic buyback law, and so when the forecast returned to positive, we first went in the November 04 forecast to 81.9, then we went to 84.3 in the subsequent forecast, then 84.3. And that, after that, we got all the way back to 90-10, and then the property tax recognition shift went from that 48% to all the way to 10.8 with a $265.9 million payment. And then in the next forecast, we went all the way to zero. So it got bought back fairly quickly because of that law. And that law was generated out of this committee.
Out of what?
Committee.
This is the contingent buyback. It's laws of 04, 272, Article 3, Section 1. That's where we created this. This was the forecast bill at that time. In order of precedence, we'll have to pay back first the cash flow account, then the budget reserve, the payment shift, and the recognition shift. Shifts are paid back when the Commissioner of Finance, quote, determines there will be a positive unrestricted budgetary general fund balance at the close of the biennium. So basically, when we go from the black to the, or from the red to the black, that's when this would kick in. And we, as I've already said, we've used it once to pay back those 0203 shifts. Are there questions about that? This is kind of the end of the shifty part. Okay. In the 2001 reform, we did a number of things. You've seen these charts before. But it does give the percentages that Senator Han was looking for. In the 2002 year, we were at 67.33 on the general ed and referendum. split. We went down to 4%. The intent was to buy it all out, but there were some referendums that passed that year. And here's where we are in the most recent year. So we're not, you know, we're not even halfway back yet to where we were. Is that helpful, Senator Hamm?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Hamm. And,
Mr. Nauman, yes, I guess the thing that I was trying to get clarity on for purposes of the committee is that we have, as a result of 2001, the tax reform, and actually going back to the 70s, I think, is we have been moving in a direction to bring more of the finance responsibility for education to state resources, I believe. And I don't know if you've got data that would talk about this compared to other states, but we do have a fairly high proportion of our funding that comes from state resources. And I just raise that because I think there are, in addition to the finance implications, that policy implications that go to, for example, the connection of local voters to their local board, local school district, the amount of responsibility that we should have or do have at the local level for paying for schools. And I guess the point that to me is that we have assumed as a state a fairly large proportion of funding that I think may have some implications for how closely connected people are to their local schools. And my own bias is that I'm not so sure it's the best policy to do it that way, but I guess I think it's important to point out that that's what we have been doing, and I think there are some bills even currently coming down the road that would push this even further. And I just raise this as a point to keep in mind for the
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hamm, in addition to that point, I think there's an important structural question for this committee to wrestle with in terms of revenue stability. In the 2001 reforms, we brushed over very quickly the notion of how stable are the sales income and corp taxes at the state level vis-a-vis the education finance system. We had about a third of our system that was paid for off of education, and I think by definition, as we buy it out, as we put more state aid in, we're replacing property tax, which everyone loves to hate, and I understand that, but it is a stabler tax than those other two taxes. So I think that if stability is something that we value, I think that that's an important consideration for this committee to wrestle with, as well as the tax committee. Arguably, we had a more stable system then. Maybe there was a higher value of paying for education, not on the backs of the property tax, but I think that it is an important push-pull for this committee to wrestle with as we move forward.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nauman, I reluctantly opened my mouth on the subject of property tax because I can get carried away real fast. But what there are unpaid property taxes, and what do you know about the current state of property taxes and their stability? If people are having their homes foreclosed on and losing it, they obviously aren't paying a property tax. What's happening then? Are we having an increased amount of taxes owed that are sitting there? What do we know about that,
Mr. Chairman? Senator Olson,
do we have anything to shift? And I mean, that would affect both the shifts. It would affect the revenue available, or all kinds of things. So, what goes on with that,
Mr. Chairman? Senator Olson, I think when property taxes are unpaid, they're unpaid, and that leaves the cities and counties, the local level, end up going through a process of placing liens against homes, and eventually you could lose your home as a result of that.
I know that.
The policy question, I think, for this committee to think about is, what is the tolerance for using the property tax lever, as we talked about on Tuesday, as a way of balancing the budget? Because there's the inevitable, we can only go so far before it really begins to sting and create problems. We can't tax people out of their homes and assume that we're going to get all the revenue and the budget will be fine.
Yeah. Senator Olson.
Yeah, there was an article, many of you wouldn't have seen it because it was, I think, in the West Metro section of the Star Tribune, about a constituent of mine who bought her family summer cabin and has been living in it. The family lived in it. Now she is living in it. And she's having a struggle trying to keep it because the lot and it's probably not a very big lot at that, is valued at $910,000, and the structure that she lives in is valued at $1,000. And so if, you know, depending on, you got to have a lot of income to pay that tax. And last night I was at a board meeting for a nonprofit that I'm on, and with the reduction of the limited market value going off, the property tax obligation for that organization on their property is going from $8,000 to $23,000 in 1 year. And, the nonprofits aren't exactly flush right now either. So, I mean, there's a lot of things going on with the property tax that I think we should be very careful of what we do to make those matters worse.
Of course.
I mean, those are anecdotal, and they, I'm sure, affect different people differently. But, I mean, I do have some real problems with the ad valorem and the way in which the values are handled.
Mr. Nauman.
Okay, so here's what we did in 2003, and I think there was a question about this in terms of, I don't remember what the context was, but I added this back in. We used this a little bit, maybe 4 years ago, just to talk about what we did in 2003, and I think it's a little bit relevant now because that's the last time we struggled with a large deficit in the state. The Education Committee had, out of conference committee, $621.9 million target. Of that, we shifted $436.9. That was about 70% of the total. And we converted state aid at the level of 21.7. And with the increased property values, that did expand over time. We eliminated the statutory growth factors. This was ABE and special ed. And that saved $79.8 million. And then we made actual programmatic cuts of 83.5, and the percentages of the total are listed there. Then the effect of those changes in the next biennium kind of looks like this. There's some lagging effects to a shift whenever you do one, and the savings was about 77.6, but it drops to about 15.8% of the total. Again, to Senator Bonhoff's point, and others have made this, the one-time nature of shifts. The conversion of state aid to property taxes grew a little, thank you, to 29.6% of the total. But here's what was interesting in that year. The statutory growth factors, the expanding nature of the special ed, grew to 205, 41.7% of the total, and then the programmatic cuts grew to 179. So when you – the target, of course – was smaller in that year. It was only 491, but the one-time nature bore a lot of the burden, and then the other factors came into play in the second biennium.
Senator Bonham.
Mr. Chair, thank you. In terms of eliminating the growth factors, I think we all have experienced the pain from our school districts after having done that, and so I, for one, hope that we don't choose a remedy like that again. Because that, really when you think about it, there was growth, we just didn't recognize it. And so that wasn't very accurate.
That's special. Okay, so that gets us through the budget. Pupil accounting, I'll go through fairly quickly because we've talked about this before. ADM, I talked to you before, we make counts on both a resident basis and a pupil served basis. The served has some calculations of pluses and minuses based on open enrollment. Then we do the weights. These weights are different from when you saw them the last time we give this presentation. Out of the House of Representatives in 2007, they were strong advocates on behalf of all-day kindergarten, so we increased the weights from 0.557 to 0.612. If you plot them, that's that tail on the front end. This used to be relatively flat. Of course, you double it because it's the kindergarten kids go to school for half time, so that 0.612 turns into a much higher number. So it now looks like what the psychometricians say makes sense. Not all the way there yet, but money spent early is better money spent. So we're now seeing that we're getting closer. The combination of the 99 changes and that change from 07 gets you to a closer pattern. Of course, the tail at the end is still pretty high. These are the calculations for resident marginal cost pupil units. Members will recall that if you're a declining enrollment district, you count basically, you only have to recognize, you get to continue to count 23% of your decline from the prior year. Growing districts, we don't adjust the marginality for those. So they count 100% of the current year. These are the calculations for doing the compensatory pupil units, which lead into your compensatory formula, and I will just get through these quickly. I think what's important to know here that the higher concentration of kids of in impoverished environments generates higher money for the school district. And these are the counts for LEP, and these have not changed. If there's questions, I will dwell on them. Otherwise, we'll just get right into the education programs. The general education, the big one, of course, is the formula allowance. It's the number we burn into law multiplied times the number of kids. In 2009, the entitlement is $4.8 billion, almost $4.9 billion. And this is the history of the formula allowance. Notice between 2002 and 2003, there's a big jump in the formula allowance, and that was the 415 roll-in. Somewhat controversial. Some loved it. Some despised it. But that was the effect of it. Extended time revenue. These are for extended time kids going to school in the summer, after school. A formula was created in 2003, I think. The formula allowance at the time was 4601, and we burned this one at that amount. There's $61 million in that formula. Compensatory, I think the key policy question here is its concentration of poverty. The PS Minnesota folks have talked about a poverty formula that is not linked to concentration. So to the extent that we're talking about that, that will be an issue for all of us. And, of course, this one in current law is linked to the basic formula allowance. So you add a dollar to the formula, and it passes through into compensatory. I am going through these things quickly, so.
Senator Saltzman.
My voice again. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nauman, I think it was back in, was it like 95, 96, when AFDC was basically how you dealt with compensatory. I mean, that was sort of the formula. And were there any other factors in AFDC? Because I know there was a lot of discussion of what do we use to provide compensatory revenue, and free and reduced lunch seem to be the best factor. Are you familiar with AFDC? What other factors? Was that similar? Because I know there was discussion of other factors, such as the fact that there may be children who are poor, but there are children who are really living in poverty. With a transition, you know, the kids and who are moving around, and is there any sort of factor within AFDC?
Well, as we talked about a little bit earlier, Mr. Chairman, Senator Saltzman, that we did make a change at that point from the AFDC formula, primarily because of the changes that were happening at the federal level to the welfare eligibility. People were timing out, and that was the reason we switched from AFDC, which was a pretty good measure up to that point. But because of the federal law, we knew that folks were going to fall off, and we didn't want that to deleteriously affect the school system. So that's why we made the switch to free and reduced lunch. It's not perfect because of the notion that we talked about before, where a lot of high school kids don't want to sign up for the free lunch eligibility, even though they might be eligible. But I think schools are generally figuring out ways to get around that. I'm not sure I'm getting at what you are talking about, but that's what I'm familiar with on the point.
Senator Saltzman.
Well, I think on that point, Mr. Chair, I think that that was some of the discussion that when this kicked in, that there were some arguments that there are other factors as well that might be considered. Is free and reduced lunch really distributing the money the way that it should be? And that will always be a debate. But I just wanted to know if there were other factors. I'm not really familiar with AFDC.
You mean other new factors? Is that what you're thinking?
Well, I think there were some issues of when you look at kids who struggle And is language an issue? Is it just free and reduced lunch, or is it the stability of the child's environment? What other kind of factors really should drive additional a need-based formula? And is just free and reduced lunch the best need-based formula? That's another discussion. I mean, that's...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Salzman, of course it's not the only factor. It's the best one that we have for driving the revenue for the purposes that the legislature has identified under this formula. In 98, we had some conversations about trying to use some data off the state tax forms, but we quickly blundered into privacy issues that just sort of put a halt to that. I don't know if that's an issue that's relevant to think about again, but that was what we blundered into at that point.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, and after some of our discussions yesterday and looking at this, I don't have we ever paid much attention to what the results of this infusion of money based on this have done? I mean, there's students that are identified in a broad category that have extra needs, and so we put extra money in. But part of it, has there been improved student achievement as a result of that? Do we ever, I don't know if we ever ask that. And, I think maybe the day is coming, especially as we're looking at proposals for changing those formulas, what is it we're trying to get? And is it just been, because we haven't had any accountability attached to it, it's just money that's there and being spent and not necessarily producing anything? I'm jumping to conclusions because I don't think we've ever seen, but I don't know that we've ever seen any evidence. And I wouldn't think that would be that hard to identify given the testing programs that we have now. Maybe we should ask the department to see if they could do something there. And I'm not suggesting that we penalize, but I think it isn't wrong of us to have an expectation when we're infusing a fairly substantial amount of money to help kids, and yet we've got the worst gap, achievement gap of any state in the union. I'm really saddened by that, and I think that we've got to start grappling with that between policy and funding.
It's a very legitimate issue. I think the results of what, in a number of different areas, I think it would be good to invite the department in and try to find out what the results would be in special ed and LEP and some of the other programs to try to get a handle on. Are we treating these all as separate silos, or are we looking at the student as a multiple recipient of many different services? Because I think some of them kind of go hand in hand. There is some disturbing information that I have no clue as to whether it's true or not. It's so hard to kind of pinpoint. So it would be good to get the department in. One factor or one piece of information that I heard was that there's a significant number of special ed students that should not really be in special ed, that once you get into special ed, there's like about a 5% chance of ever getting it back out. I think it would be good for the committee to have as much information about what's going on as possible. So I think that's something that we could do.
To that point,
Senator Olson and Senator.
Well, Mr. Chairman, not only is it not the 5%, but there's particularly in those largest or fastest growing categories. When you have the federal head of special ed saying that the bulk of the students that are in the learning disabled, in particular, and to some extent in the emotional behavioral, are instructional casualties. And if we get, that's one of the things that has been driving Senator Saltzman and I think others on this committee, is that if we can deal with that reading issue, and get good teaching early on so that before third grade, we probably would be feeding less students into those categories, which is an automatic savings because we don't get enough money to cover the cost of what we're paying for, and then they're stuck there because they aren't getting that kind of instruction even in the special ed programs. That's the other thing that we've learned. So it's if we don't deal with that, we're going to have continued aggravation of the cost of education in relation to the return that we're getting.
I had a meeting the other day with some people from the intermediate districts, and one of the things that we did a few years ago was to institute a safety levy for schools, and I think a lot of us don't realize we think of our schools in our districts as being quite education driven and somewhat homogeneous, especially in rural areas. But they were discussing how the facilities, a number of the students that they deal with are level 4 type students, and level 5 is basically a
287. You must have been talking to
is a basically a reformatory type
yes.
situation. So what has happened is that there's been a tremendous push of services required from the education institutions, from our education system, to include a whole lot more than what we have ever done before. At the same time, we haven't really recognized that in a financial sense.
To that point,
Senator Olson,
that last year we went on a tour of that place. I've been there several times in the 287, the facility is secured. The teachers put their lives in jeopardy on the line trying to work with them, and they're having to operate dually, trying to manage behavior. And almost like a police officer, as well as trying to teach. And then we visited the Glen Lake school, that the Hennepin County Homeschool, which is a corrections model. And so they live there. They are supervised. There's correctional officers that handle all of that behavioral things. And the 287 is delivering the educational services there, and they're actually being able to teach them something. But what's the irony of this is that Hennepin County is trying to back away from, as 287 would love to get closer to that model so they could actually teach something, and Hennepin County is trying, because it is costly, is trying to move away from it. So we've got our hands full of resolving that issue.
Senator Saxon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regards to the whole idea of, poverty and putting in extra money and coming up with achievement, I think it's important, and it'll be interesting to see when Blandon comes in and gives its testimony on its early intervention and its early childhood program. You're going to see some results of what extra investment at an early age can do to those people who are in poverty. And, of course, that affects special education. I think we all realize that. So that I think that'll be interesting for you to see, Senator Olson.
I do, this committee took a fairly bold step a couple years ago, and I think we could. I hope we don't lose sight of how we might save money in the long run, because the reading proposal was one of those initiatives. The early childhood is one of those initiatives. I think if we find a consensus and agreement that there are some solutions on the long term, that we should be sure that we try to forge ahead, and if we're going to make reductions, not to make reductions in those areas, because I do think that that's going to be beneficial for the long term versus just a short-sighted short-term. Senator Hand, I believe, and then Senator Bonham.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I don't want to necessarily take the conversation away from the current topic here, but I did want to ask a question of Mr. Nauman on the compensatory. Is that an appropriate interruption here?
Sure.
Can I just get back to your your slide, Mr. Nauman. In this compensatory, your last little sentence there talks about how this is computed, and just for clarification, all students get the basic aid formula of 5,100. In addition, if you have compensatory students, they would receive an additional 5,100 minus the 415. Is that how to read that?
Mr. Chairman, the way to think about that is it's the amount of compensatory pupil units, which I blazed through on a previous slide, multiplied times the basic formula allowance. And the way we count compensatory pupil units, they weight in the formula if you're a reduced lunch kid as a half and a free lunch kid as a whole. So that calculation multiplied times the formula minus 415. So it's not the full formula allowance. We're discounting it for the roll-in of the 415.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Young, but that is in addition to the basic aid.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, to your point, yes, it is in addition.
And just a follow-up question to that.
Senator Hand.
I guess two things. One, do we have a rough idea of the number of pupil units that the compensatory revenue accrues to? Is there we've got 800 and some thousand students. So what is the percentage of all those students that would be eligible? That would be one question. And then second thing, just for clarification, I believe that the compensatory revenues do not follow the student to a charter school. Can you confirm that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hand, no, I believe they would follow. They would. Compensatory revenue law is very clear that it goes directly to the site where the school district or charter, and for this purpose, charters are considered districts. So, yes, the money flows through. I'll get you the account of the compensatory units. It's not nearly as high as that, but I'll get you a precise number.
Senator Bonhoff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to what Senator Saltzman said about the compensatory and looking at, you know, are we appropriately targeting our resources where these kids in poverty are? And just remember that we had this task force last year in the interim that was a joint House, Senate, and the commissioner took part in it. Senator Koch was on it. Several people here were part of that. And what we came to was that we had not taken into account the number of ESL students or ELL students, for example, and that now poverty is spread more around the state than we had previously thought. And so that bill that, the House has been championing all summer has reflected some of those changes by putting more into some of those formulas in a different targeted way. And I think the hesitancy, at least I have had, and I think other members of the committee has had, is around that question of how do we know that that's actually going to fix the problem? And so I think our bent has been more towards how can we use our resources in a more targeted way to get results, for example, in these after-school programs or in early childhood or, you know, literacy. And so I think that's what we're wrestling with, is that we know we aren't hitting the achievement gap. We know we have these pockets of poverty. We have the ELL. We have the breakdowns of the family. But are we going to get the outcome if we just increase the formula allowance in these ways?
Senator Cole.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would just echo a lot of what Senator Bonhoff just said, having worked on that committee. I mean, I think what we're working on is very important. I'm just not certain that bill is the direction we need to be. However, I have a technical question then for Mr. Nauman.
Sure.
Okay, so it's if you have a free lunch student, it's 5,124. They get an additional 5,124 minus the 415. The concentration is my question. How does the concentration figure, and then what is...
Let me back up.
Okay.
Is this... I sort of slipped over this when we were talking about the pupil counts. If I can find it. I've gone too far.
Okay.
So based on students that are eligible for free and reduced price lunch in each school building, and the formula, and the free lunch students count as one, and the reduced lunch students count as a half, and the great, and this is kind of simplistic, but as a rule of thumb, the greater the concentration of students equal for F&R in a particular building, the higher number of concentration units are used. You know, generally, if you have a 60% concentration, same number of total kids, but if the concentration is 60% at one building and 50% at another building, that's going to generate more units. It's a more complex formula than that, but that's the way to think about it, and it is dealt with at the building level. Some school districts, and Anoka-Hennepin famously, likes to talk about, we've got the largest number of compensatory units in the state, but yet we're not generating the most compensatory revenue. And the answer is right, because the formula weighs concentration. And for many, many years, and this may be changing, I don't know, that's an answer for you all, it has been the concentration of poverty that has been the predictor of less or reduced performance. So to improve that, we've put more money as a result of the concentration. Is that helpful?
That's exactly
it. Senator Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think to that point, Mr. Nauman, is that a student who's in one school, and if a district attempts to, whether it's an integration issue or an achievement level, but trying to really ensure that all schools are more balanced in the students that they serve, we are sort of rewarding schools that put these children together and that we provide more dollars. And I think that's a policy issue and an issue of does it work? Do those children have, do those students have more needs? At the same time, being from a district where people don't think of Stillwater and South Washington as having needs, we do have, because in Woodbury especially, we have been a leader in affordable housing and Habitat for Humanity. And because of that, we have growing numbers of students coming in, and our schools are not prepared. While they're relatively small numbers, I would say that because we don't have the numbers, it's harder to provide because of different language issues. So in some ways, is there an efficiency factor when you have a larger concentration? So I don't have the answer, but just several things I think that we might want to think about in that respect. And with charter schools, I know we have this other working group. We are going to be talking a little bit about schools that are being developed to serve a specific population or group of students, and I think that's also part of the discussion of and how funding is that done sometimes to secure additional funding, or is that the best educational setting? So good policy questions, but things I think we're all thinking about.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Saltzman, to your point, it's an important policy question as you think about compensatory, because there is in a sense, a perverse incentive here, a theoretical one. Has Anoka-Hennepin done the right thing and spread their kids that are eligible for free and reduced lunch out amongst the school district and so that you're not concentrating in one particular area? Or is that just a happenstance of where they happen to live and where they are choosing to enroll? Conversely, Minneapolis, more importantly, on the north side, high concentrations of poverty. Is that happening because Minneapolis is choosing to put them in those concentrated districts schools to generate more money? Or is that a happenstance of housing policy? And I don't have the answer for that, but in the mid-90s, when we were talking about this formula based on concentration, I think the feeling was that the formula is designed to recognize what is happening there and try to mitigate some of those effects. But now, there certainly is a potential incentive. I don't know whether, and I don't think any of us will be able to know whether it's generating change on the part of a school district in terms of where they're gearing kids to go, especially in an open enrollment environment. But I think it's important for us to struggle with the question. Mr. Chairman, shall I continue?
Please.
The next is limited English proficiency. This may generate some conversation, too. Members will recall that in LEP, we have two basic formulas. We're multiplying $700 times the greater of 20, or the LEP units. The LEP functions as a cap, or the $20 functions as a cap. And then we have, again, a concentration factor here where we're multiplying 250 times the LEP pupil units only, and that's a concentration factor. And then you add those two together to get your total LEP revenue. And perhaps this may go to some of Senator Salzman's point that the LEP formula does function for often there's an alignment of kids that have a reduced ability to speak English and their poverty status. So this is another factor that in some respects gets at some of the same kids, not all also. $40.9 million of revenue here. Sparsity revenue, this is mostly an outstate Minnesota formula. Obviously, it's comprised of two factors, an elementary sparsity and secondary sparsity. It's a fairly complex formula that deals with the location of a school relative to the next nearest school, and the sparser the district, the more revenue you generate. This program is also linked to the formula allowance, so you add a dollar there, and it generates additional revenue here as well. $22.5 million of revenue in fiscal year 2009.
I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Terizri.
Mr. Nauman, I would like to get an example of expenses that are covered through this formula. I understand the next one that you're going to explain, the transportation sparsity. Could you tell me a little bit about what are some of the programs that are covered under this particular formula?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, Senator Torres-Ray, I think the way to think about a lot of these, with the exception of operating capital, which we'll talk about in a few moments, where there are specific requirements of where the money is spent. There is no statutory requirement that sparsity revenue be spent on a particular item. So similar to compensatory or the general formula allowance, it's provided to the district to deal with a factor. In this case, it's sparseness. That sparseness generates additional burdens because there's fewer kids to generate revenue, and that there's, in a sense, a fixed cost to a school district. So it's more a factor that generates money, but there isn't a comparable source of expenditures that the districts must spend the money on with this particular item.
Mr. Chairman,
Senator Terizri.
I understand the issue of fewer numbers. I think what I'm trying to get at is, what is the connection between these numbers being sparse and being fewer? So I understand the compensation that needs to occur for serving 10 children versus 20. But I think what I'm trying to figure out is the expense that is covered based on that sparsity. And transportation, again, I get it, because obviously you have to transport individuals that leave, you know, apart in farther distances. But what would be an example of something that, beyond the fewer number, what is the sparsity exactly covered in this particular formula? I think is what I'm trying to ask.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, do you want to go to me or Senator Salzman?
Senator Salzman.
Perhaps on that point, Mr. Chair, you know, before I was elected, I worked with 60 school districts across the state. And they were our largest in Okehennepin and some of our smallest. And just to maybe give an example, even though the Stillwater School District you don't think of as a sparsity issue, but one of our schools is in Marine on St. Croix. And it's located far away. We have, I think there's 30 miles from one end of our district to the other.
And an example, and I don't think we get sparsity revenue, but I could see this happening in a rural school district where because of it's a smaller community, nobody plans how many kids are going to be in each grade. But what you might have is you have a class of 30 kids, and all of a sudden you've only got like 15 fourth graders. Or because of enrollment changes or something, in our district, we can accommodate that. You know, we have an average class size, and across the district, not all of our schools are the same size because of attendance areas or just fluctuations in the number of kids in a particular grade level. But, you know, I saw when I visited a lot of schools in greater Minnesota, you know, when I represented schools for equity in education, we had fluctuations like that where because you're drawing from a very large area, there are additional costs perhaps in one particular school, and it may be hard to balance that. When you're in a more concentrated area, you can make like perhaps more adjustments. A lot of these school districts also are not qualifying for a lot of the other categoricals. You know, that was the one thing that we see, that a lot of these schools may get compensatory, but you know, for a lot of schools who really just rely on the basic formula, sparsity is something that helps them sort of level out the playing field on issues. So that would just be my suggestion of how I might see sparsity assist a district because of fluctuations in population.
Senator Bonhoeff.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Senator Torres-Ray, I look at it as, you know, that there's a certain cost of just being a school district. You know, what does it take to provide an excellent education in terms of classroom materials, in terms of course offerings, in terms of quality of teachers, and that the way we fund our schools is through a per pupil formula. And so, you know, there's a certain middle-sized school district that because of the per pupil, they have the resources to provide the most excellent education. And then, you know, the challenges in the metro area where they have the poverty and this and that, that's not enough for them. But if you look at the rural districts where if you look at a per pupil basis, they actually may not have enough money to make certain those kids get, you know, Spanish, French, the same basic education that the kids in the West Metro might have. And so sparsity, I look at as offsetting that they may not have the amount of just dollars flowing to their school districts to provide the same standard of education.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I think for all of us, if you haven't looked at the teacher-to-student ratio thing that's in our today's materials, and if you look down to the teacher-student ratios in the places that have less than 10, they kind of stick out. Here's Kelleher and Red Lake, and you turn the page and you find here's 9, Herman Norcross, Evansville. Some of us, you know, probably haven't, if we ever knew where some of them were, we've forgotten. Lake Benton and Ballaton and Lind.
Yannette Lake,
Brewster, that are all less than 10. And our Constitution, not our Constitution, but our compulsory attendance law, never mind the Spanish and some of the things that we would look at as a good education, there's requirements, and we have licensure requirements in order to provide staffing to cover for this. It is going to cost more. I mean, that's, I think, one of the things that frustrates us, and it's one of the things that Senator Bonhoeff is talking about in terms of shared services. I think there's going to be more conversation of this, is how can you, in fact, work to enable smaller districts to deliver education to the smaller numbers of students that they have in a way that doesn't drive the expenses. You know, at what point do you know, nobody likes to talk consolidation, and when you do, you end up having transportation going all over the board. You know, that becomes the expensive item. You know, can we capture technology? Can we do other things? What is it we can do that would help, you know, not only help, because these people don't complain about class size, that their classes are too large. They're getting personal attention. But there is a price. So that, I think that's the sparsity thing, that we go in this state from one end to the other.
Senator Torres-Ray.
Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons I asked the question is precisely that. I think I do understand what sparsity is supposed to mean, but I think that the problem that I have with the definition is that this is not about providing quality to 10 kids or 12. This is about finding a way to put together these formulas, which at the end really do not say that we are responsible for providing this quality education to these 10 children. And so the reason I ask the question is not so much that I don't understand sparsity, but perhaps that we need to redefine really how we allocate our formulas, because I understand exactly what Senator Bonhoeff and Senator Salzman, Senator Olson are explaining. But that's not what the formula says. The formula simply says that we compensate schools because there are fewer children that live farther apart. The formula does not say that we have to educate every child in every school, regardless of the size of the school, with high-quality education and provide the funding that is needed. And so I point it out because I think that as we think about, you know, reframing and reorganizing our funding, I have a particular problem with this formula, not because, obviously, for the reasons that have been explained, I understand that perfectly, but because how it is defined. So ultimately, the formula does not include language under statute that says we need to educate these children in an equitable way, whether they are 10 children that live in a rural, isolated county, or in Minneapolis. So, you know, I think it is important that we recognize that and figure out a way to put that language and that in place, because that's what we really want to do in this committee.
Senator Olson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think on page 3 of our handouts is the constitutional mandate, and I think that's the thing that we kind of grapple with, that we are to establish a general and uniform system of public schools, and the legislature is to make such provisions by taxation or otherwise as will secure a thorough and efficient system of public schools throughout the state. And as I said, in our compulsory attendance law, we've got a cadre of subject areas that all, you know, it doesn't say necessarily say the specific quality, because that can vary in any school district, in any classroom, of the actual instruction. But we have our licensure laws. All of these factors are there as we have attempted to carry out our mandate. And one of the things that's been determined in some of these rural areas is that it costs more when you have fewer and you don't have the economy of scale. Even to the level of what, you know, we think of 12 to 15 or whatever is a good class size. Some of them are below that, and yet we have an obligation to educate them too. So make a note, Senator Stump, that a suburban legislator is defending your rural concerns.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Mr. Nauman.
Mr. Chairman, I think I'll just, since we've kind of talked about sparsity as a collection, we'll go. There's also transportation sparsity, and we have $60.9 million of that. Operating capital is an item that has a list of required places that you've got to spend the money. It's a little bit of a formula to create. First, we create a maintenance cost index, which is geared to the weight, the age of the school buildings. And then we have a series of allowances. Remember, we talked about that term before. $5 primarily for technology. Then there's an equipment piece and a facilities piece. You multiply the facilities times the maintenance cost index, then add that to the 68 and the 5 times the pupil units gets you your money. Districts with learning year programs receive an additional $30 per pupil at the learning year site. And this revenue has to be spent on, there's a collection of about 8 to 12 things that the money has to be spent on. And the reason for that, of course, is this is to deal with the operating capital costs, tuck pointing of a building, put a new roof on, buy a new boiler, those kinds of things. And in some cases, obviously, it's not enough, and they often come to this committee and say, hey, let's do a fund transfer. Or they're doing fine, and they'll say, give us a fund transfer to take this money and put it into something else. Those are the kinds of issues that you often deal with. $194.2 million, of which $120.9 million is levy and $73.3 million is aid. Prior to the '02 session, this was all aid. That $120.9 million in '09 is a policy choice that the legislature made at that point. This is some of the levy that we backed out of state aid to help balance the budget at that point.
Senator Salzman.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Nauman, we talked about this briefly in the charter school working group. Charter schools also get operating capital, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Salzman, correct.
Yes, and Mr. Chair, there's one more question then. So because they do not have the ability to levy, do they just get the aid portion, or do they get an enhanced operating capital amount?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Salzman, it's computed a little different for charter schools. Their portion is, in fact, all aid because they don't have a tax base. But what we do is we generate aid for those charters based on the statewide average revenue. And that's how we handle it for all general education programs. Basically compute a statewide average and then use that multiplied times their units.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Nauman.
So, Mr. Chairman, equity, I had about 7 slides to go through the equity program in the past. Ms. McQuay said that I was being too verbose, so I slimmed it down. This is our most complicated form. I mean that with affection.
Thank you.
I'm sure everyone thanks her. It's calculated. This program was created in 1999 to provide low property wealth districts who are unable to pass a referendum with additional revenue. That was the original intent. The legislature over time has frequently amended this and used this as sort of a bill balancing mechanism. It's a great way to balance out the bill if some school districts are getting not sufficient revenue. Again, I mean that with affection as well. We've added about 3 additional purposes to this program over time. This also used to be a completely state aid program, and we backed out levy in that same session that I talked about with operating capital. It's now $94.5 million in levy or in revenue, $74.4 million levy, and the aid is $20.1. And I will make this quick. Equity number one throws districts into 2 different pots. You're either a metro district or you're an outstate Minnesota district. Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Duluth are made ineligible for equity number one. All districts receive $13 per pupil, and those with an operating referendum, even if it's 1 cent of an operating referendum per kid, you get the money on the sliding scale, and we create a regional gap within your grouping, the difference between the 95th percentile and the 5th percentile. And then we create a district gap, a specific district relative to the 95th percentile, divide one over the other to get an index. And then we use this formula, $13 added to the 75 weighted by the index times the units gets your equity one revenue. And equity two, directed at the small, mostly rural districts, provides revenue based on a district's computed allowance multiplied times the district's pupil units, and the allowance is equal to the difference between 10% of the statewide average referendum per pupil unit. And we go through all that calculation, and then we cap it at 100,000. So it's really the smaller districts. Equity three is for the metro area only. This was part of a compromise in 2005, I believe. It's designed to recognize the perceived higher costs of being a metro district, that there is, in fact, a higher cost of living in the metro area. So this formula was created for that purpose. And it's basically the sum of your equity 1 and 2 revenue multiplied times 1.25. So in effect, what it's doing is weighting those first two formulas at a higher rate. And of course, if you remember equity 1, people are looking at me, yes, this is a confusing formula. If you remember equity 1, Minneapolis and St. Paul are not eligible for this. So you multiply 1 times 1.25 times nothing, and it's nothing. Equity 4, this one could, in fact, be a formula allowance. It started as $46 times your units if you were below the 95th percentile and 23 if you were above it. And then along the way, we changed it to everybody gets $46 per pupil. So in effect, this is a second formula allowance. It's confusing.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, we were doing all of this about the time we were talking about greater simplicity, too, weren't we, for the formula?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, you might think that I couldn't possibly comment.
But Mr. Chairman, when I know you're not quite through with all of this, but could you just kind of put together in a simple list all of the hunks that have a levy? In other words, the levies that we've authorized without that the school boards make the decision about, and not the voters. And
certainly.
Maybe distinguish.
Do you still have it in your packet for
us to see that, especially as it relates to if we're doing any consideration of property tax recognition shift and that type of thing as to, because we took over the whole formula and that reform, but all of a sudden that's been creeping back up. Mm-hmm. And we may be sitting here puzzled. Now, how did that happen? And I think you're exposing the different ones and reminding us of which ones are predominantly levy versus aid.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, are you thinking about just those levies in the general education program or the whole six pages that we handed out on Tuesday?
Maybe I missed that then. Okay. If you've got all six pages of levies?
I think it was six pages, Senator
Olson. It's actually this sheet here that's titled E-12 Property Tax Tracking Sheet.
I hope it was saved in my...
Probably is in there.
Is it in my save folder?
If not, we'll get you a copy.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, I think the way to think about that is that the voters approve debt service levies and the voters approve an operating referendum and the rest.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Question, Mr. Chair?
Senator Bono.
Mr. Nauman, going back to the equity formula, equity number 3 revenue, if it's for districts in the metro area only and it's a multiplier against equity number 2 and Minneapolis and St. Paul, and I presume the suburban schools also don't get equity number 2, who does get equity number 3?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Bonoff, Minneapolis and St. Paul and Duluth are excluded from equity, what I call equity number 1. That's the 95th percentile calculation on the sliding scale. They would not receive equity number 3. Every other district in the metro area, unless you're above the 95th percentile, would qualify for equity number 1. And predominantly because I'm not sure, there might be a district or two that qualifies for equity 2. It's the sum of 1 and 2 multiplied times 1.25 that generates equity 3. So the suburban districts would, in fact, get a bump off of this revenue piece. The outstate Minnesota would not.
Senator Olson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, what did we remove that 95th percentile thing from?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, that was a Senator Olson bill in,
yes,
I believe, 07.
Which of these 95th percentile things did we remove that from? Was it
It was equity 4, and when equity 4 was first created, it was $23 per pupil for every district above the 95th percentile and $46 for every district below the 95th percentile. And Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, your bill changed that to everyone receiving 46.
But that didn't change how we applied that 95th percentile and a couple of the other equity things.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olson, no. It did not make a change to the what I would call the core equity one piece. That's the largest piece of the money.
So, Mr. Chairman, I think Senator this is Olson. One category that will merit some attention as we work through our our formula this year.
Senator Hann.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nelman. Just to clarify, example, suburban district that is not at that 95th gets equity revenue number one.
They do receive equity
they
number one?
They do receive equity. Is that correct? If they, unless they're in that top tier.
Yes.
Okay. Other than Minneapolis, St. Paul, or Duluth. And in addition, they would get equity number three. So they would kind of get a two-plus effect of whatever that revenue
Mr. Nowak.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hann, the way to think about that is you would you get a basically an extra bump off of equity three if you qualify for equity one by virtue of being in the metro area to recognize the increased costs of the metro area.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nowak, what I'm trying to get at is if you get some dollars off the equity one formula and you're in the metro area, you would get an additional amount that would be actually more than double. Is that correct? Because equity three takes the one times 1.25.
It's one times 1.25.
So they would be getting 2.25 the factor. So it's kind of a doubling of the formula if you're in the metro area.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hann, that was the compromise.
Senator Bonhoeff. And
Mr. Chair, Senator Hann. But you may find that you don't get much equity off equity number one. So, you know, a large bump off nothing is still.
Senator Phoebe.
Mr. Chairman, is there a cap on equity number three like there is on equity number two?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Phoebe, in a sense, because the equity one primarily is based on a formula that has an allowance that functions as a cap, exceed the amount of that allowance. Let me back up. It might be helpful. Sorry. Get the direction of my mouse going the right way. See that $13 plus the 75 times the allowance times the units. That functions as an implicit cap. It's statutorily determined. It doesn't work quite the same way as equity two, which is more of a floating allowance based on your district's relative position to the statewide average referendum.
Mr. Nauman?
Okay. Wasn't that fun? training and experience revenue is an older formula that is, I say this every time we do this, gradually phasing out. It was a formula that back when we recognized the costs of senior teachers, we at one point in Minnesota's history, we determined that that was a statewide responsibility to recognize, and we created a T&E index, and we subtracted 0.8 off of it, and multiplied it times 660, and then times the formula, times the units of the district. It was a very complex formula to create that that index. And at some point, I think out of this committee, we began to feel collectively that recognizing individual higher cost of teachers was a local decision. Perhaps the referendum was designed to deal with that question as well. And we began to phase it out. So we locked it in at the pupils or the teacher seniorities that if you were a teacher on the books and went back to 1996-97, you could still generate revenue off of this line item. But it's been gradually phasing out, and we're now only down to about $1.3 million. At some point along the way, I think in fiscal 10, it begins to dip even below a million. This may be something we want to consider just for repealing or going the other direction, if that's your pleasure.
At some point, most of those teachers will be retired, I would think.
Mr. Chairman, that was the idea. That's how it phases out.
And what's the aid levy mix on that?
Mr. Chairman, that program is all aid. Gifted and Talented Revenue is a relatively new program. $9 times the pupil units. I think the first year we did this, well, 2006, $11.4 million. This one also functions similar to the formula allowance in that it's an allowance times the units. The difference here, though, is that the dollars have to be spent on gifted and talented programs. Transition revenue, this was part of the budget balancing efforts in 2003. We created a temporary hold harmless as we were making changes in other places. This is an aid levy program, but the revenues generated by the lesser of the district's 03-04 revenue per pupil had no law changes been made in 03. It's the only time that I can think of we got a formula where it's geared to if something hadn't happened, and then or the district's 02-03 revenue. And then we locked that allowance in and multiply it into the future times the units. And beginning in 05, this was an aid levy mix. It's $29.7 million statewide. The Q-Count program, I'm going to try to get through these quickly, creates incentives to pay teachers based on merit rather than seniority. Members are really familiar with this program. Basically, the allowance is $260 per pupil in revenue. It is an aid levy mix program. Not all eligible districts can qualify for this program. Department of Education determines eligibility. The reason that if everyone in the state decided they wanted to do it is that there is a statewide overall cap on both aid and levy, so that limits the overall participation. In the last legislative session, the legislature limited the program, limited new participants for 09 and 10. The rationale behind that, it's my understanding, was that because the agency was forecasting that full participation would occur all the way up to the cap, and that had not been the experience, the interest among districts and charters was not as robust as the forecast was assuming. Those dollars were recaptured and spent in other places. But that is effective only for 09 and 10, and it comes off in 11. And there's the total revenues. Operating referendum, the cap is at 1294. There is some inflationary growth. Sparsity districts may exceed the cap. Again, the mix conversation relates to that aid levy split conversation we started with at the beginning. Referendum is based on resident pupil count because that's tied directly to the property tax base of a district. The aid portion is portable. If a school district, if a student open enrolls into another district, they can take that aid with them. The formula is pretty simple. It's the allowance times the pupil units. And we do have a conversation here about how the equalization works. There's two tiers. First tier is equalized at $476,000 of referendum market value per pupil, and the second tier is $270,000 per pupil. And so members are familiar. This is where you ask a school district asks the voters to approve additional revenue. And we do walk you through this formula. I will make it quick. If $750 times 2,000 equals $1.5 million in revenue, and that's just a hypothetical, but we do make an aid levy calculation, and this is similar to how we do it in other places. I will blitz through this. I think members know that it's basically taking the money on the first tier and on the second tier, dividing it by the equalization factor per pupil to generate the aid levy split. And in the example that I'm using here, end up with, here's a total levy, which of the 1.5, 454,000 is levy, and there's the aid, and then there's the aid levy percentage. If you'd like to go through that at some point, I'll be happy to come back to it. I think it's important for the current year to talk a little bit about something that came out of last year's legislative session, which was the one-time basic formula. This was the $51 per pupil multiplied times the units. It was in the 08 finance bill. It does not pass through to compensatory sparsity or transportation sparsity because it's just one-time money. It also doesn't affect the referendum cap. It's not statutory or built into the base beyond fiscal year 09. So I would anticipate that as we move forward in the conversation, that the school districts will probably characterize it, as they often do, is if you don't give us this $51, that is an implicit cut. Maybe, depending on how you look at it. It is $51 per pupil that they have this year. Next year it's not in the base, so they don't have it. They'll probably want you to reauthorize it. But that'll be about $51 million that we would have to come up with somewhere. So I mentioned that for you to think about. It's $48.5 million in total revenue in the state.
Do we know we also allow them to transfer some money, $51?
Mr. Chairman, that was a separate policy that we also authorized. School districts that had a fund balance, we would allow them to make that transfer of 51 so that, in a sense, they could claim 2% if they so chose.
Do we know how many districts did that?
I don't off the top of my head, but we can get that. Okay. So, Mr. Chairman and members, we'll go through some of the reserves and penalties. There is a learning and development revenue operating reserve revenue for staff development, operating capital, and telecommunications access and contract settlement deadline penalty, all of which I think are important policy questions. Senator Hahn asked us to talk a little bit about class size, and I thought it was important to do that, and maybe in the context of the learning and development revenue. This program was begun in 1993, enhanced in 1999, sometimes referred to as the class size reduction revenue, requires districts to reserve general education revenue to maintain a class size of 17 to 1 for kindergarten to grade 3. We have about $179 million reserved statewide for this program. We did prepare a run for the most, I think it was fiscal year 09, that shows how that money is distributed. We do this program in a unique way. It's built into the formula allowance and other programs based on pupil weights. It's not an allowance multiplied times the units. So it's built in as a 0.57 of 0.057. So it's that little bit of increment that is built into the weights that generates this revenue, and then districts are required to reserve it for that purpose. There's some out for school districts if they've already maintained that, if they've already achieved those ratios. Senator Hahn, I'll pause here because I know that you had a desire to chat a little bit about that. If that continues to be the case, I'll keep going.
Well, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Nauman, I appreciate your putting together the data. The thing that I wanted to, I guess, ask a little bit is, I know all of us, and I certainly have had conversations with people about large class sizes, and as I've tried to source that out and gone out to the department's website and found information, it's been hard to validate the anecdotal stories that are heard. And so I thought maybe we need to have some conversation about what we're seeing here in your data, which would show that the class sizes on average there's about a 14 to 1 ratio across the state, and with a maximum of 20 in school districts and a minimum of about 5. And I know that this is an average, and as somebody once said, if your head's in the oven and your feet are in the freezer, you're on average you're comfortable. And so I know there's lots of variation that you could see, although the 20 to 5 is kind of the range of the variation here. But can you comment a little bit and help to understand what is the dynamic? Why do we have people that come and we talk to as individuals, and they say, well, gee, we've got class sizes of 30 in our school, or we've got 35 kids in a class. What is the dynamic that's going on there, and why is that not reflected in the data that you provided that is the FTE to student ratio numbers?
Mr. Bowen.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, obviously these data don't look down to the level of each individual classroom. I'm sure there are circumstances where some individual classes have ratios that are described there. To really get down to why someone might say, and taking the statement at face value, well, geez, the ratio is 30-1 in our classroom. We'd have to measure every single classroom in the state, and we don't have the data to do that. I think what we can say, though, is on the average, we are pretty close to where the learning and development statute and the revenue that flows through it intends us to be. That doesn't mean that in every case we are there. I know Governor Ventura wanted to be able to walk into every room and say, ah, there's 17-1, good, we're meeting the mandate.
And Mr. Chairman and Mr. Hammond,
Senator, yeah.
Is it fair to assume then that what we see in districts is every district is different and they may have different class offerings at the high school level, or they have different ratios of elementary to high school, that as they're trying to staff appropriately, that you could have classes that are higher than these average numbers, but those reflect decisions that school districts are making locally to try to manage whatever constraints that is that the dynamic that we're hearing reported anecdotally from people when they say, gee, we've got, quote, high class sizes in our district. And sometimes I've gone out and looked at up their school on the internet, and I don't see it. And so I'm just trying to understand what is going on and where would be the person to, I mean, should that person then go back to the school and district and say, why are these decisions being made when overall for our district that shows a 15-1 ratio, but in this class we have 30-1? Is that
Mr. Chairman, Senator Hahn, I think one thing to think about, I mean, the answer is yes. A lot of this are locally determined decisions. The state's position on through our statutes, through the learning and development policy, is that we're focused on grades K to 3, but also the statute extends to grades 4 to 6 if the revenue is available. It doesn't really speak beyond that to the upper grades. So to the extent that somebody is saying, oh, my high school kids are having to deal with ratios of 30-1, well, the learning and development statute doesn't really speak to that point. I can speak anecdotally that I'm aware that some districts sell their operating referendum based on class size, Minneapolis being the most recent example. We'll keep our class sizes down if you pass this referendum. And that's sort of an implicit promise that the board makes to the voters when they're selling their referendum. There's an example of a local decision. I'm not sure that makes it a state responsibility beyond the learning development statute.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to... just make a couple comments on the run itself. There were a couple of qualifications that I'd just like to put in. This is data taken from the department, and in the report card language in the statute, we've asked the department, the legislature has asked the department to give teacher to student ratios using both licensed teachers and licensed professionals. And up to this point, the department has had significant difficulty doing that, and I think that's also reflected in the run. The teachers are, the data used for that is licensed FTE, and the data used for the students is the October 1 enrollment. So it's a point-in-time enrollment, not an average over the course of the school year. Another point I'd like to just point out on the run is that the maximums, the minimums, and the averages are calculated using just school districts and excluding charter schools. The outliers in the charter schools can get a little fuzzy, and so I didn't want that to affect the min and max and average.
Does the average reflect the K-12, or does it reflect the first three grades?
Mr. Chair, the average includes K through 12.
Okay. Senator Saltzman.
Mr. Chair, we've talked earlier about special education, and it would be interesting if there was a way to take out teachers who are working with our special needs students, because we know that many times it's a 1-to-5 ratio or a 1-to-2 ratio, or someone's working on a one-on-one basis as a speech pathologist or a therapist. So I think this kind of information is really interesting, but, you know, it's the explanation that takes 5 minutes to the public of, well, where are you putting all these teachers? You know, are they all on having a coffee break? Or, you know, why aren't they in the classroom? And I think, I don't know how we could do that, but I think that's something that's really missing here when we look at class sizes, because the number of students that a district serves that have special needs is really going to impact how these numbers compare. So that would probably be very difficult. But
yeah, Mr.
Helpful.
Chairman, Senator Saltzman, it is a limitation of the data. We can't get into every individual circumstance. It's something to think about. So I'll quickly go through the reserve revenue. Members also know that we require school districts to reserve a 2% of the basic formula amount allowance, which is about $102 per pupil for staff development. Districts may opt out of this requirement if the school board and the majority of the teachers agree to do so. In the past, this committee has talked about maybe putting a hold on that requirement in an environment where we are not providing new revenue to districts. I'm not sure if that's something that is on the table for you all to talk about, but that's something you've talked about in the past. Similarly, we've also dealt with the contract settlement deadline in a similar nature. There is a $25 penalty per pupil in the first year of a biennium, right at the settlement time, if districts and the teachers' union fail to reach collective bargaining by January 15th. So that's an issue to think about. We set it aside in 2001-02 and the 2002-03 bargaining cycles. And I think that concludes most of what I have to say, and we'll flip over to special ed and
Ms. McQuay.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll just go quickly in the next 20 minutes over the special education and then the early childhood budget information. The special education budget includes a regular special education excess cost and special pupil aid with the children with disabilities. Those are the major factors playing into the special education budget. Regular special education revenue is calculated based on a percentage. The state special education is the responsibility of the federal government, the local government, and the state government. The state's portion is calculated based on percentages. That is 68% of the salaries, 52% of the contracted costs, and 47% of the supplies. What happened in 2008 was that special education became calculated based on current year estimates. Prior to that, it was calculated based on a two-year lag, and then an adjustment factor was added into that. The department felt that they could go to a current year estimate. The data got more sophisticated, and I think this improved the accuracy of the special education calculations. Also of note, the state total amount of revenue is capped and prorated to all districts. The total appropriation in fiscal year 09 was $716.9 million, the entitlement. Excess cost aid is available to districts when their unreimbursed special education costs exceed 4.36% of their general education revenue. This amount is also capped and prorated to districts. That capped amount was $110.8 million in fiscal year 09.
Members, I'll quickly add that cap that Dr. McQuay is talking about is the elimination of the statutory growth factors that we talked about. We did that in 03. And you've restored some of it, but it hasn't all been restored.
It would be nice to have that difference that...
Mr. Chairman, I think we do.
Okay.
Coming up.
Mr. Chair, there and members, there were a couple of changes that have been made since fiscal year or since the 2007 legislative session. Part C was rolled into the regular education revenue. The transition disabled revenue was also rolled in. This began in fiscal year 09, and if you look at your appropriation spreadsheet, you'll see that transition disabled was zeroed out. Not really, it just got rolled into the regular special education. What Mr. Nauman spoke of was the program growth factors. They were reinstated from the 2003 numbers, and that's for regular special education, that's 4.6% for the regular and 2% for the excess cost. And also what I spoke of in a previous slide was that two-year lag in the calculation was eliminated, so we're now looking at current data to help make the calculation. The other change that was made beginning in fiscal year 2007, and districts had, I think a lot of your districts, because they were special education co-ops, wanted to be exempt from this new tuition billing program. I think several of you will recall those exemptions. All districts are now in this tuition billing program. Prior to fiscal year 2007, districts would create their own bills, send them out to District A, would send their bill to District B. District B would send their payment to District A, and it was done all at a district level. With the new tuition billing system, special education, those calculations are made at the department level, and districts then see their billing changed as a in their general education payments. And so special education is paid to resident districts by reducing the amount of their general education equal to the cost of providing instruction, their general plus their general education revenue and referendum revenue equalization aid minus any special education that's already been received, minus general education revenue if the pupil is in the regular is outside the regular classroom for more than 60% of the day. Overall, this simplifies the tuition billings because districts, students do have the option to open enroll to other districts, and when it's done at a department level, there are more consistencies in what is categorized as special education versus another, like early education.
Is that true for charter schools as well?
Mr. Chair, yes. They're also included in that.
Mr. Chairman, one of the big benefits is we get rid of all that billing back and forth.
The transition disabled revenue, which I spoke of, that was rolled into the regular education line item is still calculated individually. It provides additional state aid to districts with programs in the career and technical area. This is a formula that works similar to how special education, which is based on percentages based, 68% of the salaries. And like I said, it was rolled in. The special education pupil aid is a program for students that are in care and treatment facilities, and the parents have terminated their parental rights, or the parent or guardian lives outside the state, or is a resident of a correctional facility, or just a resident district cannot be determined. In these situations, the district can bill the state for the cost of educating these special education students. And the total for that in fiscal year 2009 was $2.3 million. Home-based travel aid is another one. Districts are reimbursed for 50% of the travel costs for providing services to children with disabilities who are under the age of 5. This is just a little diversion. It gets into Mr. Chair, what you were talking about earlier is the difference between the cap gap. If you look at the red line, that is the total amount that districts are spending on special education. This includes the local portion, the federal portion, and the state portion. The blue line, or the one with the diamonds, is the special education revenues. This is This is the amount that's capped in statute. You look then, the 4 points in the pink are what the revenues should be for special education based on the statutory percentage calculations that we actually calculate for special education revenue. So then the cap gap is the difference then between the pink line and the blue line. What we've statutorily determined special education should be, what we statutorily determine the state should pay for special education versus what we actually pay. Another way to look at the cap gap is through the cross subsidies. This is what districts are paying out of funds other than special education, mainly their general education program, to cover the cost of their special education programs, which is a federally mandated program. That number was slowly increasing from 99 to, or rapidly increasing, till fiscal year 2007. And in the 2007 legislature then put money into special education, not totally reaching the point where they're covering the cap gap, but a significant portion of it. And you can see then the cross subsidies reduced in fiscal year 2008. Then we see in the following fiscal years, 2009, 10, and 11, that number begins to increase again. The cross subsidy is due in part to the funding caps on regular aid and special education regular and special education excess costs. There's both of those funding streams are capped. There is an adjustment factor that we can calculate, which is the ratio of the statutory funding level. That would be the pink line in your previous plot to the state total adjusted base revenue. In fiscal year 2009, the special education regular adjustment cap was 84.7%. That's the capped amount versus the revenue amount, what the state has committed to pay versus what they actually pay. And the statewide adjustment factors can be calculated for regular special education and for excess cost. You can see a significant amount of fluctuation in the excess cost area, and that would be these plots are from Dr. Melcher at the Department of Education. And I think he's made the point that those adjustment factors for regular and excess cost can be misleading because of the interaction between the two formulas. And this has gone through an example of that. But you can see on this plot the overall impact of the caps when you add together, when you take off the caps for both regular and excess cost and put that ratio against, or put that calculation against the capped ratio or the capped calculation, so you can look at the special education as a program in whole, you'll see that this is the statewide or the adjustment factor for special education. You can see from fiscal year 2007 to fiscal year 2008 that the adjustment factor rose from 83% to 92% because of the increased amount that was put into special education. And that number slowly trickles back down to 83%.
Basically, what's happening here, members, is that the costs of special ed are exceeding even the growth that we put in. That's why the percentage is coming down.
Taking the percentages and putting them into actual values, you'll see that the cap gap was $155.6 million in fiscal year 2007. When the money was put in to fiscal year 2008, that cap gap was reduced, and it's again growing.
Well, this is the budget forecasting. This is the January
stuff. I think that would be a good point to pause if there's any questions on the special education program.
How closely is the special education costs tied to health care costs?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, just I haven't thought about it in those terms. I'm not sure there would be a direct linkage, but I can't say that it's divorced either. We'd probably want to talk to Dr. Melcher about that for more detail.
Like what percent of the total special ed would be made up of health care services that are purchased either?
I don't think it would be a huge percentage.
Senator Bonham.
Mr. Chair, I sit on the autism task force with Senator Senjum, and the numbers of autistic children have grown exponentially, and the services required to care for them once they get in. It's interesting. I've discovered that before they're in school, those costs come through the healthcare field, but then once they're in school, they still need those same services, but they become, quote, educational related services. And so I wonder about that also.
Mr. Chair and members, there is what's called third party billing, and I don't believe we make it mandatory in statute, but whenever possible, districts are supposed to bill, I think the third party in most cases would be an insurance company, for the cost of what would be covered in that. I don't know the extent to which that covers special education, but there is, I guess, a good faith effort by districts to do that.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps we can get some information for you on that.
Senator Saltzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Nauman, would it be possible to also see if we could find, along with this, because these are like dollar amounts, the number of special education students who use these services and then like an average cost, just to be able to see.
Sure.
I'm sure that's something that we've seen before, but just to look at what's the percentage of increase in special ed and is the average cost per student going up, and which I'm sure,
sure,
maybe because of inflation or also because of more expensive services needed. Thank you.
We can pull those data out of the model, yeah.
Members, this might be a good place to break. I know you have a little bit left, but and I think next week it's my understanding that we would not meet until Thursday, right? If we do,
you wouldn't need a what?
Not until Thursday.
Thursday, because I don't think there's meeting on Tuesday or Wednesday. So, Senator Saltzman.
On the Thursday date, Mr. Chair, I know that Schools for Equity and Education is having their legislative kickoff that morning.
Okay.
I think from 8:30 to 10, and some of us will probably be attending that.
Sure.
Which was that?
So
okay.
Schools for Equity and Education is doing their, it's a group legislative kickoff.
Thursday.
I think it's at the Kelly Inn on Thursday. And it may be over by 10, so.
I thought it was way faster than that.
So, Mr.
We'll have some time next week to let you know.
Yeah. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman, just to conclude, we threw the staff resources up. The previous slide also has some website addresses that we think are useful for additional information. Of course, we're always looking to improve this for next year. So if members have advice or criticisms, we would happily accept those.
Well, I think I can speak for all of the committee members. We really appreciate our professional staff and the information that they provide. And we also know that many of the members can come to you, or any of the members can come to you and ask for information. And they've been very, very willing to provide it. So we extend our appreciation to
thank you.
The hard work that all of you do.
Mr. Chairman, we always enjoy this day because we think it's a good back and forth, so we hope it's been useful.
Right. Committee is adjourned.